Sclerosing disorders are comprised of a variety of cutaneous diseases, including depositional disorders and disorders of fibroblast overgrowth. In our last dialogue, Dr. Heidi Jacoby and Dr. Todd Schlesinger discuss sclerosing skin conditions.
I'm Dr. Todd Schlesinger, and we're going to talk today with Dr. Heidi Jacoby of UT Southwestern about sclerosing dermatoses. And I figured, Dr. Jacoby, if you just say one or two words about your background in clinical practice setting.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me to speak. And I'm at UT Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas, Texas, in the Department of Dermatology, where my practice consists predominantly of seeing patients with sclerosing skin conditions. And we also have a very large phototherapy center that offers UVA1 phototherapy, which is one modality we've been able to offer our patients with sclerosing skin conditions.
Wonderful. So in the realm of the clinician's dermatology practice, why should we care so much about sclerosing dermatoses?
Well, I think the number one reason is because we still are the predominant physicians who can diagnose these conditions and actually differentiate one from another. The second is that we are often in the front lines in terms of making the correct diagnosis and then making sure the patients are referred to the appropriate providers if necessary. And then third is that we can offer a wide array of treatment choices, including phototherapy, topical medications, as well as systemic medications to provide some relief for these patients.
It sounds like you have a very comprehensive clinic there. So speaking about the average practitioner that's in practice today, where would they start as far as making the diagnosis if someone presents with a condition that they feel might be in that category? What's the first thing they can do as far as making a diagnosis goes?
Sure. So sclerosing skin conditions oftentimes present in the perception of the patient as a thickening or hardening of their skin. And so when a patient presents with that type of complaint, there are two things that are really important, as with all patients, is history and physical exam. So it's important first in the history to ascertain from the patients where the lesions started and how they've progressed, because actually where the lesions start and how they progress over the body can help discern that many of the entities in the differential diagnosis here. The second is to understand how the lesions have evolved over time. Many of these lesions can begin as inflammatory, where they're erythematous and oftentimes not as indurated, but then progress to become more indurated and or hyperpigmented. So their evolution over time is very important as well. The third thing is many of these disorders accompany other underlying conditions. For example, people who've had a bone marrow transplant, who have chronic graft versus host disease, or exposures to certain chemotherapeutic agents. And so it's important to ascertain historically what is going on with the patient, and that might provide a clue as well. In addition, some of these disorders, such as scleroderma, present with accompanying signs such as Raynaud's phenomenon, so it's important to look for that as well. And the physical exam, I always have my patients in a gown because frequently they have lesions that they might not appreciate on the rest of their body, and you would want to examine them not only for the presence and extent of these sclerosing skin conditions and palpate those lesions, but also for signs of other disorders that might be helpful. One example being nail fold capillary change, for example, in someone where you might suspect scleroderma. Another might be a distribution just on the lower extremities and signs of venous stasis in the case of lipodermatosclerosis.
Okay, so it sounds like there are a lot of good ways to diagnose sclerosing conditions by physical exam and history. What are some of the concomitant conditions that you see, medical conditions that are associated that we have to look for in clinical practice?
So to step back just a little bit for the differential diagnosis, and that will kind of guide us in terms of the concomitant medical conditions. So what we could focus in on today, because this is such a huge category of disorders, are disorders that I broadly group as disorders of excessive collagen deposition and extracellular matrix deposition rather than an overgrowth of fibroblasts. So within that group of disorders, you basically have morphia and some of the entities that may or may not be related. The categorization is somewhat controversial, including eosinophilic fasciitis. And then also included with that is scleroderma. And then some of the entities that we see that are also within this category or can be confused include radiation dermatitis, as well as lipodermatosclerosis and chronic graft versus host disease. So if we concentrate on those entities, and as well as drug-related sclerosing skin conditions, the drugs that are typically associated would be the taxanes, bleomycin, and some of the other chemotherapeutic agents have been implicated in sclerosing skin conditions. In addition, historically, in the case of eosinophilic fasciitis, there's the toxic rapeseed oil and L-tryptophan, although those cases seem to have subsided. And then in the case of graft versus host disease, obviously a history of most likely a bone marrow transplant, but occasionally some solid organ transplants, particularly liver transplants.
Is the next step to take a biopsy to take a look at the histopathology of the condition?
Yes. So once you've kind of ascertained those aspects, you can do a biopsy. And certainly from that list, you would be able to discern entities like lipodermatosclerosis and graft versus host disease, and probably eosinophilic fasciitis by the deep involvement in the presence of eosinophils. But what is important to remember is the biopsy is not going to be completely helpful because it won't reliably discern morphea from scleroderma, which can be identical on histopathology. And from there, you would actually have to do clinicopathologic correlation with what you see examining the patient as well as the history to discern between those two. So biopsies, I think, are most helpful to discern between general disorders in this category, as well as some of the other things like scleromyxedema and such, but they won't help you discern morphea from scleroderma.
So speaking of the biopsy, and then it's not helpful for everything, but it can work, it can help you discern some conditions. Underlying inflammation, is there any way to correlate the underlying inflammatory pathways that are present in the different types of sclerosing conditions with the biopsy, that back to the patient?
Well, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of data in that area, but I think it can be helpful, aside from just making the diagnosis, but also if you are trying to ascertain whether a lesion is active and inflammatory or not. And so in some cases, the biopsy can be helpful for that because you look for the inflammatory cell infiltrate in addition to just the collagen and extracellular matrix materials.
And then speaking of clinical pathological correlation, what are the first other tests that the clinician might think of running when they're trying to determine which diagnosis their patient may have?
Sure. Well, I think that really laboratory tests might not be terribly helpful with most of these. It's really the clinical distribution of the lesions and the accompanying signs and symptoms. Of course, as we move further along in our discussion, when you talk about scleroderma, lab tests there can be very helpful because there are a large percentage of patients with scleroderma have antinuclear antibodies, and they also have three hallmark scleroderma antibodies, anti-centromere, anti-SCL70, and anti-RNA polymerase antibodies, which if present are very specific for scleroderma, but unfortunately not present in all cases. In the case of eosinophilic fasciitis, you might expect to see a circulating eosinophilia in 80 to 90% of patients. They also tend to have elevation of markers of inflammation more frequently than the other disorders in this category, including elevated ESRs, and they can also have hypergammaglobulinemia. And so that might be helpful, as well as the eosinophils on pathology for a diagnosis of eosinophilic fasciitis.
And how far do you go into working up the medical conditions that the patient has? As far as, do you have a multidisciplinary team that helps you work up if they have lung disease or renal disease or whatnot?
I do. Well, they're not necessarily in clinic with me, but I have a series of people that I refer to. And I probably, just because this, I see a lot of these patients go further in the workup than your typical dermatologist.
Okay, that's all very, very good information. What are some of the rarest forms of sclerosing conditions that the clinician might encounter, but they may have only seen on board exams or in residency, whatnot? What are those ones that we just don't see quite as often, but want to be aware that they exist?
I think I would probably just underscore under the category, if you don't think about it, you won't diagnose it category, mm-hmm. that I think is really important that you don't want to miss is, I mentioned the breast cancer already, but there are case reports of DFSP mimicking kind of deeply sclerotic morphea lesions, so dermatofibrous sarcoma protuberans. In terms of just the rare zebras, there are, of course, your hereditary disorders that can cause sclerodermoid skin changes. So in that that category are things like progeria, Werner's syndrome, and some others. Usually, of course, those are accompanied with a childhood onset and a number of other conditions as well. Also in the rare category is stiff skin syndrome, which is also usually a childhood onset disorder. There's actually a great recent paper where a genetic association was discovered with a genetic defect in fibrillin. And what characterizes that disorder is very densely, very thickened skin where it's almost so hard it's as if you can knock on it. And the biopsy is distinct at the in that there's really no inflammation whatsoever there, which goes along with the fact of the relationship with the genetic defect. And that, again, is predominant in children. So that would be something I would be concerned about, perhaps differentiating generalized morphea, for example, in a child. But it tends to be much more extensive, as I said, and deep without the inflammation.
It's good to know you have to go back to those books sometimes that we haven't taken out since residency.
Right. I would also maybe add in the POEM syndrome, which historically was always board fodder for the morpheiform disorders, along with the polyendocrinopathy and the organomegaly. So.
And POEM stands for, again?
Polyendocrinopathy and the organomegaly and the myopathy. Yeah.
Yep. One thing I found interesting was that there's not a lot of data into the underlying inflammation. Is there any current research being done that's helping us to understand more about these conditions?
There's a number of people looking at some different aspects of morphea. We have recently completed a large series of biopsies that we performed on patients, as well as recorded kind of the clinical presentation of them for clinical pathologic correlation. And so we've been looking at that, and hopefully we'll have that out for publication soon. We also recently performed some transcriptional profiling of the skin of these patients compared with non-lesional skin that was presented at the American College of Rheumatology meeting in 2013, which we're in process of having submitted for publication as well. So I think that that will give us a lot of insight into not only the inflammatory cell infiltrate, but also the inflammatory pathways that are involved in these early lesions, of which this preliminary evidence certainly seems to point to the fact that there is a very brisk inflammatory role for that type of thing early in the disease.
All right, so there's been some research in acne that shows that the inflammation precedes the development. You know, when they're looking at biopsies of lesional and non-lesional skin, they're seeing the inflammation coming even before comedo. Is it similar where the inflammation is preceding the development of the clinical lesion, and that even in non-lesional skin, you're still seeing some early inflammation happening there?
We, in our site-matched non-lesional skin, we didn't see any inflammation, but what we looked at were early inflammatory untreated lesions. And without a doubt, there's the gene transcripts that are upregulated have to do with interferon-mediated inflammatory pathways, B cells, as well as T cells and natural killer cells. So, and that's congruent with other work that has been done in morphea that also points towards this kind of interferon-mediated immune response. So I think the current hypothesis is that, just as you point out with acne, that early on these inflammatory events occur that recruit activated T cells into the skin. And what hopefully we'll learn more about is how that then provokes this kind of imbalance of collagen metabolism, where you rev up the fibroblast to produce more collagen and not break it down as well. So that seems to be the current evidence, although interestingly, in our pathology study, we did find dense inflammatory cell infiltrates with plasma cells and lymphocytes and occasionally eosinophils with a very brisk and exuberant amount of collagen. So it's interesting, because what we don't know about that is that continuing to drive continued sclerosis. And so when you turn off the inflammation, you get less, or is, so we don't know quite the relationship. But it's really fascinating, because one theory could be that this inflammatory infiltrate in the presence of all this collagen means you're continuing to drive more and more collagen deposition. But that's purely conjecture at this point, so hopefully we'll learn more.
It sounds like a lot to do with the adaptive immune system, and there's been a lot of current talk about adaptive versus innate immune system with cancellations and all that. Is there any role for the innate immune pathways involving toll-like receptors and antimicrobial peptides in sclerosing dermatoses, or is it all adaptive?
Primarily? I mean, there's so little evidence, so I hate to speculate very much, but I think there has not been much evidence for innate. I think it's much more adaptive in nature, and so.
So circling back around, we've talked a lot about research, how to diagnose and whatnot. Let's talk a little bit about therapy. So what are the different therapies you start first line, second line, third line, and how far can it really go? And
well, I think probably most dermatologists will encounter a bit more morphia, and so we can start with that. So basically, when you see someone with morphia, once you've made the diagnosis, it's important to do two things. The first is to ascertain what subtype of morphia it is. And there's actually a number of different schema for subtypes. I prefer to use the one that was published by Zulian and Laxer. And they basically delineate circumscribed or plaque morphia, linear morphia, generalized, mixed, and pansclerotic. And most of what dermatologists will encounter is linear, which predominates in children and young adults, and that encompasses a linear distribution of lesions that can occur in the extremities, trunk, or face. Oftentimes in the forehead, it's called un coup de sable, and it sometimes can be accompanied by progressive hemifacial atrophy or Peyer-Romberg. And so any dermatologist who deals with children will see this will be kind of the predominant form that they see. This can be dermal only, or it can be subcutaneous, or even go down to the fascia and bone. The second subtype that I think dermatologists see frequently is the circumscribed or plaque, and that's the textbook picture we all think of kind of that plaque with the central sclerosis and the violaceous border. So these are usually round plaques, oftentimes in the trunk, and oftentimes they can either also, again, be dermal or go very deep down into the subcutis, which you can tell by just palpating the lesions, and you can feel that almost bound down nature of it to the underlying tissue. The final type is generalized, which is more than four plaques and more than two body surface sites. So that's probably the one that's least frequently diagnosed, because if you go by that criteria, I think that there's a lot more people with generalized than people recognize, because the perception is they have to be covered. And that can be usually what you see are those oval plaques become quite coalescent. And again, that can be very dermal, and it can also involve the subcutis. So if we concentrate on those, the circumscribed and the generalized are going to predominate in adults. So that's the first thing, is to figure out the subtype, because that will tell you a little bit about the demographics as well as the severity. Obviously, greater body surface area, as with all many skin conditions, is worse. Also, you'd want to look at, is there a threat for functional impairment in terms of if these lesions are very deep and crossing over joints, or involving important cosmetic sites, for example, such as the face. Those are all signs that perhaps we want to be a bit more vigilant in observing those patients and aggressive in treating them. The second thing is that activity is important, because the window for meaningful intervention is when the disease is active. And so if the disease is inactive and what we see is just the damage that it's left behind, medical treatments and such will not make much difference. So there's actually been some consensus groups that have come together in pediatric rheumatology and decided on some useful clinical criteria for active lesions. And those include the development of new lesions, the extension of existing lesions, and the presence of an erythematous or violaceous indurated border surrounding the lesions. So that's the second step, is to ascertain, is it active or inactive? Because obviously active disease will be handled a bit differently. So then, once you've decided it's active, you take together the distribution and body surface area involvement, the depth of the lesions, and also the threat of functional or cosmetic impairment, and you decide how aggressively you would like to treat the patients from there.
And the most common therapies?
Yeah. We actually looked at this a while back. The most common therapy is actually prescribed by dermatologists as topical steroids. The irony is there's absolutely no evidence for their efficacy. Mm-hmm. My personal opinion is that what happens with them is that we traditionally employ something very high potency, oftentimes under occlusion. And what it seems to do is atrophy the overlying epidermis and do very little for all that dermal or deeper sclerosis. So I think for patients who have limited dermal lesions, either the circumscribed or even very limited linear lesions that are not rapidly progressive and threatening function or cosmesis, you can start either with a topical, such as Protopic or calcipotriene under occlusion, or you can also try intralesional Kenalog, particularly for the more thickly sclerotic lesions, and you would want to aim your injections kind of at that advancing erythematous border, and you can repeat those monthly. If you move into lesions that are dermal but more widely distributed, my choice there usually is going to be phototherapy, because if you see someone where the lesions are progressing to greater body surface area, a topical will only chase them. And what we really want to do is shut it down and prevent the patient from getting more. And so phototherapy is a great option. We have the benefit of UVA1 at my center, but there are studies showing efficacy for narrowband UVB, as well as UVA without sorolens. So those are great options for that patient group. If patients meet criteria for what is moderate to severe disease, which is deeper lesions, crossing a joint, threatening function, systemic changes, such as sometimes you can see people with who have arthritis, especially children along with this, a deep lesion such as hemifacial atrophy, which really threatens cosmesis, you really move to the systemic immunosuppressives. And the greatest evidence right now for that is prednisone in combination with methotrexate.
Wonderful. So some great advice, great information. Is there any role for topical immunomodulators such as imiquimod in mild to moderate disease?
There are studies that report benefit of imiquimod in morphea. I will say my personal experience has been that it's been more irritating without any real clinical benefit, although there have been publications that support its use.
And then finally, any resources that the practicing physician should go to when they want to learn more?
I'm happy to help out people a lot. You can always send me an email. Unfortunately, you actually bring up a great point, which is that the internet is very misleading. And so when patients Google morphea, a lot of what they get is information about scleroderma. And so we don't have a lot of great information out there where if you just hit Google, so you have to kind of know where to look. I would also urge people to look at, there's some great reviews done by Nicole Fett in the JAD in the past couple of years. And she went over both evaluation and treatment. We also did a systematic review of treatment that was published in the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology. The Scleroderma Foundation does have some information for particularly the linear variants and such.
Well, I think Dr. Jacoby, this is very, very informative. I certainly learned a lot from speaking with you today. So thank you very much for being here and participating in Dialogue in Dermatology.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
In this dialogue, Dr. Jacoby emphasized approaches to evaluating patients with sclerosing skin diseases with focused discussion of morphea. The differential for morpheiform skin lesions is extremely broad and can include morphea, chronic graft versus host disease, lichen sclerosis, lipodermatosclerosis, injection site sclerosis from a variety of injectables, toxin exposure, nephrogenic systemic sclerosis, toxic oil syndrome, chemotherapeutic agent use, radiation-induced morphea, porphyrias, linear melorrhoestasis, reflex sympathetic dystrophy, morpheiform sarcoidosis, sclerosing congenital melanocytic nevus, morpheiform basal cell, cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, dermatofibromasarcoma protuberans, cutaneous metastases, and breast cancer. Rare conditions that cause morpheiform skin lesions include hereditary disorders, progeria, Werner's syndrome, Muckle-Wells syndrome, Winchester syndrome, asymmetric childhood scleroderma or stiff skin syndrome, and Pohm's syndrome. When approaching a patient with a sclerosing disorder, Dr. Jacoby recommended starting by obtaining a thorough history and detailed physical exam. History should include how the lesions first began, how the lesions have evolved over time, any of the exposures to medication history, environmental exposures, or comorbidities. Physical exam is guided by the history and should include ruling out the possible causes of morpheiform skin findings. For example, nail fold capillary changes. Physical exam of the lesions should also focus on determining whether the condition is active, new or extension of existing lesions, or the presence of an erythematous or violaceous indurated border is suggestive of activity. Next step in the evaluation is to obtain histopathologic data. Skin biopsies can help discern between general groups of disorders that can have similar morpheiform appearance. One important caveat is that skin biopsies cannot distinguish between morphea and scleroderma, which can be identical on histopathology. Laboratory findings are not particularly helpful in morpheiform disorders, but may point to the right diagnosis. For instance, a large percentage of patients with scleroderma have antinuclear antibody positivity, which is nonspecific, while a minority of patients may have scleroderma antibodies, i.e. anti-centromere, anti-SEL70, and anti-RNA polymerase. In a nested case control study of Morphea patients published in JAMA Dermatology in 2013 by Dr. Jacoby, the prevalence of ANA, antihistone antibodies, and anti-single-stranded DNA antibodies were found to be 34%, 12%, and 8% respectively, with ANA and AHA found more frequently in Morphea patients than controls. In the study, there was no variability of antibody titer between different Morphea subtypes. With the exception of linear Morphea, the presence of autoantibodies and other subtypes of Morphea was not associated with clinical activity or severity. Other laboratory findings may suggest one diagnosis versus another. For instance, in eosinophilic fasciitis, one might expect eosinophilia in peripheral blood in 80 to 90% of patients, as well as markers of inflammation including elevated erythrocyte sedimentation rate and hypergammaglobulinemia. However, eosinophilia can also be seen in Morphea, especially during active phases of the disease. Morphea, characterized by inflammation and deposition of collagen in the dermis, which can involve the subcutis, is one of the prototypical morpheiform skin disorders. Symptoms such as pain and pruritus and functional impairment are correlated with decreased quality of life in children and adults with Morphea. Dr. Jacoby's work suggests that skin trauma may be associated with development of Morphea. Subtypes of Morphea, as classified by Zulian and Laxer, include circumscribed or plaque, linear, and generalized. Deep involvement can occur in all subtypes of Morphea. Progression from one subtype to another is also seen. For instance, patients with plaque Morphea can progress to linear or generalized Morphea. Thus, it is important that patients with limited Morphea are followed for progression. Two important types of linear Morphea involving the face are Incudasab and progressive hemifacial atrophy of Peyer-Romberg. Both conditions can involve the subcutaneous tissue, fascia, and bone. In Incudasab, the inflammation can affect brain tissue and act as an epileptic focus. Histology and imaging, particularly ultrasound and MRI, are helpful in determining the extent of disease. Activity of disease, distribution of body surface area, depth of lesion, threat of functional or cosmetic impairment is critical in deciding the aggressiveness of therapy. Early active Morphea is most responsive to therapy. For limited disease, topical therapy is generally used, although there is very little evidence of the efficacy of topical steroids in Morphea. Topical tacrolimus and calcipotriene under occlusion may be helpful. Intralesional Kenalog can be used for thick lesions. For more widely distributed lesions, phototherapy including UVA1 is generally used. Studies have shown efficacy for narrowband UVB and UVA with sorolin as well. Approximately half of patients had recurrence of active Morphea lesions after successful treatment with UVA1 phototherapy. With the exception of increased duration of Morphea, risk of recurrence is no different in adults and children, or between Morphea types. Morphea involving the superficial to mid-dermis is more amenable to topical therapy or phototherapy. Deeper lesions need to be treated systemically. For patients with moderate to severe disease, deep lesions, crossing joint lines, threatening function or cosmesis, systemic immunosuppressive therapy is recommended. Most commonly used systemic therapy includes prednisone in combination with methotrexate. I hope you enjoyed this edition of Dialogues in Dermatology. Next month, we have a special edition dedicated to alopecia and diseases of the hair. Remember, we now have a presence on Facebook, and we'd like you to join us online for previews, info, and fun. This has been Terry Cronin with Dialogues in Dermatology. So stay passionate about dermatology and keep up all the great work you're doing on behalf of your patients. Your medical expertise, surgical skills, and your continued commitment to your patients is appreciated by your community. Have another great month.